Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin DNR. Preventing food waste and composting scraps and uneaten veggies, grains, and fruit can help the environment. More dnr.wi.gov by searching food waste.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll get some reading recommendations for your holiday weekend from, to the best of our knowledge, executive producer Steve Paulson.
First, a Wisconsin lawmaker is reintroducing a bill that would mandate that schools would have to teach students about the contributions of the Hmong. Representative Fred Kessler has tried to get the legislation off the ground in the past, but hasn't found the support for it.
Our next guest thinks this legislation is important from the state and the time is right to get it passed.
Joining us now is Yur Yang. She's a high school teacher and vice president of the Hmong 19 Council of Wisconsin. Yur, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us about why you think we need this bill.
We do need it because there's roughly about 30 to 40,000 Hmong people living in Wisconsin, and you could just imagine how many students are out there at the high school, middle school, and elementary school. And they need to be, they need to feel right about being here in America. And we studied a lot of other cultures as well. And I think it would do the students justice to learn a little bit about their own culture and where they came from and why they're here and why their parents brought them here. And it's and not only with the Hmong students, but also the mainstream students. They need to know why these strange people are here and what brought them here. So they need to know why. And there's a lot of good reasons why they need to know more about the Hmong people and their history and what caused them to come here to America.
Now, you're a high school teacher.
I'm sorry. And we do need that education in our public school education here in Wisconsin.
As a high school teacher, how do you justify teaching about one ethnic group in Wisconsin and not another? Why do you justify the Hmong?
Well, I think all the students need to know as much as they can about all cultures. Why specifically the Hmong? It's important to know about the Hmong because I know that in big cities or cities like Sheboygan or Madison or Wausau, other cities that have Hmong people, a lot of mainstream students don't know about the Hmong history, the culture. And there, of course, if you don't know it, if you don't know about the history and culture of a group of people, then there's lack of understanding and tolerance and respect. And so it is very important that we teach our students to be as open-minded. And that, of course, promotes understanding and tolerance among many ethnic groups. And I hope I answer your question.
Is this legislation, do you think, designed to address misunderstandings and tensions that have arisen over the past years about surrounding the Hmong community in the past? Is it for that?
I think it will be helpful, not only to the students, but to the parents as well. And absolutely, it will address some of the tension because the Hmong people are here to stay. You can count on that the Hmong people will be around here in Wisconsin and the United States for quite some time in the future, perhaps forever. So it is important that we learn how to get along and we learn how to understand each other's cultures. And the Hmong people, we have been, the vast majority of Hmong people in Wisconsin have pretty much assimilated in so many different ways or integrated successfully already. But again, the Hmong people, we hold on to our culture quite strongly to preserve cultural identity in addition to because a lot of the Hmong people, we worship the ancestors. So culture is an integral part of that, religion and culture as well. So most definitely what we would do everyone good to learn about each other. And that's my perspective.
What would you say are some of the main misconceptions and areas that could stand to see some light shed upon them about the Hmong people here in Wisconsin?
Mm-hmm. The Hmong people, I just want everyone to know that we are not here in America here by choice. We were refugees, and we had to leave Laos because of our affiliation with the American government or the CIA. And we need to be here to survive. And so a lot of times people think that we're here as immigrants. Maybe some are, but many, the vast majority of us here in America are here as refugees. And we need for you to understand that we are here by, I don't want to say the word force, but I want to say the word that we have to do this to survive. And that way, people need to just be tolerant and be understanding and learning more about the Hmong. We are so much, we have more similarities than differences, that's for sure. So we're not too much, too far off from everyone else here in Wisconsin.
So you're going after understanding and you're seeking that here in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. What would you like to see change in the way that the Hmong experience is processed here in Wisconsin?
In terms of this bill, we'd like to see some education process taking place in our school district here in Wisconsin. And, you know, again, I am a teacher, and I want people to realize that the teachers do have a lot of autonomy decisions in terms of what needs to be taking place in the classroom. The bill only allowed people to have the options, and perhaps the school district can say, you can introduce this bill, or you can introduce the topic of the secret war about the Hmong people and how the Hmong people were involved in the Vietnam War. Now, I also want all of us to understand that the Hmong people back in Laos, many, many of our soldiers probably always put their lives on the line so that we can stop communism on its track or the spread of communism. So we all fighting for the same reasons. And one of our top missions as Hmong soldiers was search and rescue of American pilots in addition to stop the spread of communism. So that is an important topic that we all have to realize that we are on the same side. We are friends and we're allies. And so those are the things that I want our students and our parents and the community to understand. We're not saying that you are that you are in debt, or you need to pay a debt for the Hmong people's effort to help Americans. No, not at all. We all fight a cause, and that is to fight so that people can have freedom to live a life as free as we are here in America. And I also want you to know that the Hmong people are very proud to be here in America. I am, for one, very blessed to be here in America. It has provided education and opportunities for me and many other Hmong people across America. So we're not ungrateful. We are very, very happy to be here, and we are integrated very successfully into the mainstream society. And that is the key, integrating and living the American dreams that our ancestors have provided for us. So I hope this answers your questions as well.
In terms of Hmong cultural preservation, what kinds of things are taking place that people might want to check out that could give us a better understanding of Hmong culture?
Absolutely. Hmong culture, Hmong people in general worship ancestors. And then that is a kind of religion that I think most people don't understand. In addition to that, one aspect of Hmong culture is the Hmong New Year. The way Hmong people live their lives and how they practice their religion at home. And sometimes people don't understand why we do the things that we do. And those are some of the misunderstandings out there that we're practicing witchcraft, or we do weird things and that type of thing. But Hmong culture has been in existence for thousands of years, and we are very proud of our culture and history. And we're certainly not going to let it go away anytime soon. And we would like to, it's a beautiful culture in many ways. If you study into the Hmong culture and history and religion, there's a purpose and reason behind everything that we do. And so we like to continue to preserve that. And if people don't understand, I encourage you to learn a little bit about Ask Your Neighbor, Ask Your Friend. There are a lot of Hmong educators out there too, and at the university there are programs out there. I encourage everyone to go, and this is inclusively of Hmong students who, and a young Hmong who may have grown up here and really don't have a good grasp of their own culture history, to go out there and learn some more. It will certainly promote understanding and tolerance and respect among all of us. And it is okay to be different.
I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
That was Yur Yang. She's a high school teacher and vice president of the Hmong 18 Council in Wisconsin, talking about legislation that has been reintroduced that would mandate that schools would have to teach students about the contributions of the Hmong. That introduced by Representative Fred Kessler. If you're anything like me, it's hard to keep yourself in books. In fact, I'm between good books right now, so I'm especially excited about this next segment coming up.
Steve Paulson is with us. He's executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge. He probably sees more books cross his desk, and they end up stalling there for a while, than anyone here at the station. He's the perfect guy to ask for some up-to-date book recommendations. Steve, thanks for stopping by again.
Oh, it is a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's get right to the books. I'm looking at your stack, Falling Upwards.
Falling Upwards by the British writer Richard Holmes, it's fabulous. You probably think of, when was... human flight first invented. You'd probably think, what, the Wright brothers?
Wright brothers, yeah.
Yeah, the invention of the plane. Well, actually, you have to go back to the 1780s with the hot air balloon. And it's an amazing story. So there are these stories of the early balloonists, and it's filled with sort of wonder and optimism and bravery and danger because those first balloons were actually made of paper, stitched together or held together by buttons, and it was fueled by burning hydrogen. So, you know, imagine the danger there. And Richard Holmes tells one great story after another. So going back to the very early 1800s, these balloon shows that were kind of like circus acts. And so, for instance, to tell one story, there was this young French woman, pretty young woman, Sophie Blanchard, who would attract crowds of people to come out and watch her. And she would stand sort of like in a champagne bucket, right below the balloon. It would lift hundreds of feet into the air. She'd have these flowing dresses, and she would perform tricks in the air, and sometimes fireworks would go off. You know, this is all around, you know, a very flammable balloon, and eventually, after some years, she did fall to her death in a ballooning accident. And then to tell a more optimistic story, not ballooning. Ballooning is not just about tragedy. In 1978, there were these two East German guys who were desperate to get out of East Germany. This is back during the Iron Curtain years. And they spent about 2 years sort of looking for the pieces to build a balloon, because this is back when the secret police, the Stasi, were, you know, they would check and see if, you know, were people buying lots of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so they went and they slowly gathered propane burners and fabric and all of this stuff. And eventually, got this balloon, and just as the Stasi were closing in on them, they took off one night and went up to about 9,000 feet. And of course, in a balloon, you don't know where you're going to go. You're sort of at the mercy of the winds. And so they landed, and they didn't know where they had landed. And it turned out it was just on the West German side, and they had barely missed some high voltage lines. So amazing stories.
Those are amazing stories. It makes you wonder how the author Richard Holmes rounded those up. That's kind of a hidden history, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. Well, he spent years doing this, and it turns out that there was this whole legacy of famous writers from the 19th century, and they all talked about balloons. There was sort of this public fascination with balloons.
Do you kind of want to go up in one now?
I do, actually.
You know, I can tell, just listening to you.
So he says that, you know, going up on a hot air balloon will change your life.
Wow. Really?
And I've never been in one, and I do want to go.
Was there you think of planes or cars, there was always a race to beat the other person in the next level of technology. Was there a balloon technology race that he tells about in there?
He does talk about that, yeah. And so there are modern balloon versions of this. And there's a whole other story of ballooning, which is the science of ballooning, the science of meteorology. And so there's sort of a whole science aspect of this as well. And there are these famous scientific expeditions. There was one that was the first effort to try to go to the North Pole in a balloon, a Swedish troop. They did not make it, I understand to say.
That does not sound like a good idea. Yes. I mean, the paper was bad enough, but you add the North Pole. Well, tell us about the next selection on your list. What have you got?
It's a biography of the young Charlie Parker, the great jazz player, written by Stanley Crouch, who is a well-known jazz writer himself, a great cultural historian. It's called Kansas City Lightning, The Rise and Times of Charlie Parker. And what he really does is he focuses on the Kansas City roots of Charlie Parker, which I didn't really know anything about. And Kansas City was this mecca of jazz back in the 1930s and 40s. And so Parker grew up there in the 30s. It was, I mean, the way Stanley Crouch writes about this, it was like this town out of the Wild West, run by gangsters. The jazz clubs were basically run by gangsters, too. And the jazz was really good there. I mean, this is where Lester Young came from, Count Basie. You had to know what you were doing. And the young teenage Charlie Parker would go to these clubs, and he was actually laughed off the bandstand a couple, you know, the great Charlie Parker. He wasn't good enough. He was humiliated. So he went out and he found mentors and he taught himself, or, you know, was taught how to play. So he would spend days and hours every day playing. And eventually he helped to reinvent jazz. And I mean, and part of his whole style, I mean, it was, you know, it was partly creating this, the new sound of bebop. It was, he wanted to play really fast. So he would actually file down his mouthpieces so he could blow harder and play faster. And then there's a tragic side to the story, of course,
right.
As well, because he got hooked on heroin and ended up dying very young. And, you know, he probably had, what, 15 years maybe of playing jazz, but he changed the jazz world in that time.
So he was playing at these clubs that you're talking about owned by gangsters. It seems like it'd be easier in that case to run into that dark side of life than even, you know, we hear these stories all the time with musicians. More so when you're playing in places maybe owned by the same people selling you the heroin.
I think that's true. And I mean, part of the point that Stanley Crouch makes is that, you know, jazz wasn't just a job that you had. You know, you just didn't just go there in the evening to play jazz. It was a whole lifestyle. And Charlie Parker was immersed in that lifestyle. And then he went off to New York. And he actually, and Crouch sort of opens the book by telling this great story of kind of the moment when Charlie Parker burst onto the national scene. He was playing with this band from Kansas City, the J. McShane Orchestra, and they show up at the Savoy in Harlem, sort of the center of the jazz world in all of America. And the reigning, this was the era of the battles of the band. So, you know, these two bands would play and, you know, one would try to top the other. And the reigning kings were saying, you know, we're going to send you back to Kansas City. You're not going to cut it here. Well, Parker and company, they blew them away. And, you know, that was the beginning of a new era in jazz.
And cool to be there that night.
Yeah.
And Stanley Crouch is a heck of a writer. I've only read shorter works by him. The writing lends itself to maybe a good holiday read for people?
It does, yeah. So, and it's more than just a jazz story. It's really a piece of cultural history. And Stanley Crouch has been working on this book, I think, since 1981 or something
Wow.
like that. I mean, you know.
Can you tell when you read it that this is this is a meticulously researched
it
book?
It is, yeah. Well, he wanted to tell the story of not just jazz, but of Kansas City as well.
Interesting. All right, well, you've got one more for us, and this one is a novel. What is this one?
It is. It's called Nairobi Heat. It is by a Kenyan-American writer named Mukomo Wangugi, and it's crime fiction, actually. And there's a great backstory here because Mukomo is actually the son of one of Kenya's most famous writers, Ngugi wa Thiong'o. And Mukomo himself was born in Illinois, grew up in Kenya. So he has a thick Kenyan accent now, and then moved back to the U.S. and actually went to school in Madison. He got his Ph.D. here. And so this is it takes all the conventions of the classic detective story, and it's set partly in Madison, partly in Kenya.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And the main character is this cop, Ishmael, who is African-American. And so it's playing with these notions of racial identity. So the African-American cop in Madison, you know, in this predominantly white town, and he realizes to solve the murder, he's got to go off to Kenya. So then he becomes the black man in Kenya and is dealing with corruption and violence. And I learned a lot about Kenya, and it was also fun to see the references to Madison. And it's a really good read.
So you have called this author, that I'm not going to try to pronounce at the moment, the Stieg Larsson of Kenya. That's high praise. So is he going to be the next big thing?
He could be. I mean, it's what's really interesting is there are a lot of really good writers who are adopting the conventions of genre fiction. So in this case, crime fiction, to write about the larger society. And, you know, when you think about what Stieg Larsson did for Nordic noir, I mean, it wasn't just that he wanted to tell these good stories. He wanted to talk about neo-Nazis there and all of that. And to some degree, that is what Mukomo is doing in his Kenyan stories too. And he's crossing boundaries. So it's, you know, it's partly about race and politics in the United States, but also in Kenya. And he started this whole series. And so his detective has moved to Kenya for the second novel.
So it sounds deep, but is it still fun?
It is fun. It's absolutely fun. You turn the pages to try to figure out what happens.
We'll be borrowing
next.
That one. We're buying, supporting the writers.
Yes.
So I'll recap Falling Upwards by Richard Holmes on Ballooning, Kansas City Lightning by Stanley Crouch, and Nairobi Heat by Mukoma Wangugi. And we've got that on the Central Time Facebook page. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Always a pleasure.
That was Steve Paulson, executive producer of Wisconsin Public Radio's To the Best of Our Knowledge. And you can share your favorite new reads on our Facebook page, too. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. It's Thanksgiving week, a time when a lot of people gather with family members they don't see as often during the year, which for some people means it's time for some difficult conversations.
Our next guest calls these hard conversations coming out of the closet, and she says it's vital for everyone to come out of the closet about whatever it is they've got hidden. Our guest now is Ash Beckham. She's an LGBTQ activist, and she gave a TEDx talk in Boulder called Coming Out of Your Closet. Ash, welcome to the show.
Hey there, how are you?
I'm doing okay. I want to start with your story about how this whole TED talk you gave that went viral, how it was sparked. You have a story. What happened?
I had done a couple other talks in Boulder, and this one kind of came from a time when I was with I was working at a restaurant, and there was a little 4-year-old girl that came in, and I had gotten the question a couple times: "Are you a boy? Are you a girl?" Because I, you know, I've had short hair and, you know, dress kind of androgynously, and I was, you know, kind of ready to go at it with this little kid, because I was kind of sick and tired of getting that question. And so once we but then she asked, you know, are you a boy or a girl? And I was kind of ready to go off on her to some extent, kind of some pent-up anger. But she looked down, there's a 4-year-old looking back at you, so that's not exactly the best response. So we just had a little conversation about, you know, I like to wear clothes that are comfortable, and I know you can relate to that too, and sometimes you like to wear your pajamas. And her response was pretty simple and easy, and, oh, okay, you're a girl. Can I get a pancake? I mean, it was pretty it was pretty easy and clear, and she, you know, it wasn't, not everything is a challenge to your identity. It was just a little kid with a question, so that kind of changed my perspective on relating to other people and kind of having those hard conversations, because she was just really honest and real, and that made it pretty simple to have that conversation. So I learned a lot from a little 4-year-old kid in a pink dress I wasn't really expecting to.
So you've gone on to say that, you know, really everybody has a closet that they need to come out of, and it might be that you're gay, or it might be something else, something true about yourself that people don't know, and that holding on to these things can actually be really bad for us. You liken it to holding a grenade. Why?
Well, I think that there's, you know, something about not being true to yourself that is stifling and, you know, almost suffocating. And those things are going to go off in a variety of ways, whether it's that pent-up stress that stays inside that causes health issues, or, you know, just not being allowed to be yourself, or the stress that comes from hiding. I mean, think and keeping things from people. I think that's hard. It's like, you know, it's almost like knowing that there's somebody's throwing a surprise party. You know how stressed out you get around, like, not wanting to ruin that, and then imagine that about something so intimate. And I, you know, thought when I wrote the speech and when I delivered it, I thought I was really broadening my spectrum of what that would be. And it's been incredible, the response that I've gotten from so many folks that have written me, that have really just blown the top off any limitations of what a closet can be, from, you know, mental illness to PTSD to, you know, it's not always stuff that's bad, but it's stuff that, you know, you're afraid that society's going to have an opinion of, or the folks closest to you don't know about. And there's this, you know, perpetual circle about keeping that lie, that then not only are you telling someone something that you're afraid they're not going to approve of or like, or is going to startle them, but then also you kind of have to tell them you've been lying to them for X amount of years too. And so, you know, that's a really hard thing to say as well. So it damages relationships and friendships and kind of that factor of trust. So that was, you know, that's the grenade piece, that sometimes you just have to say it, and whatever happens, happens, and there's a freeness that comes from you no longer holding that.
Well, the thing about closets, at least that we think, is that they're safe. You know, it seems like here you are
right.
In your dark little space, and nobody can hurt you as long as you don't come out and say the big scary thing. Why is it better to come out and have that difficult conversation?
Well, you know, I think everybody has their time, and there's, you know, the closet feels safer. You know, whether it is or not, I think is kind of up to interpretation, but it feels safer than having that hard conversation. But I truly think that you know, kind of by definition, if you're living in this enclosed space and you're not opening that door, you have no idea about the world around you. You're not living in that, in a space of being able to absorb everything, and you're kind of trapped. You know, it becomes more of a prison than just a closet, and it's all you know, and it's kind of how you go through life. But there's so many things that you're missing by staying in there, and people that you're not letting in, and experiences that you can't have when you stay in there. So it's safe, but almost, you know, at a certain point, what kind of existence is that?
What is step one to having one of these difficult conversations? Are there rules of thumb?
You know, I think it's hard. I mean, I came up with kind of some principles that I use. Obviously, the first part is coming to terms with it yourself. There's no, you know, you can go and try to have those conversations with a lot of people, but until you've kind of done your work and your ownership of whatever that might be, I think it's really hard to go out and talk to somebody else. But once you claim that, whether it's an experience that happened to you or a diagnosis or whatever that might be, like once you acknowledge that exists, I think that would be the first step. And then, you know, the things that I said in the talk, you know, that are by no means the only way to do it. But my experience is, you know, be authentic. Like you just have to be yourself and not try to hide what you're doing anymore. So just be honest with, you know, this is who I am, and then be direct. I think there's a lot of times that we, you know, try to tiptoe around something to soften the blow of the person that we're giving it to, and that's just, if you're going to say it, like, just rip the Band-Aid off and say it. And then the last part, I think, is be unapologetic. Whatever closet you're coming out of, you know, whether it's, you know, you've been diagnosed with a disease, or you've cheated on somebody, or you want a divorce, or you're telling somebody you love them for the first time, or any of these things, you just can't apologize for what you're doing. And, you know, in some of those situations, if you've lied to people or people have gotten hurt, like, you can apologize for what you've done, but, you know, you don't have to apologize for who you are. Like, that is your truth, and that's the part that matters. So those were kind of the three guidelines of self-awareness, I think, that you take into it, that I think, for me personally, have been helpful in having those conversations.
I suppose sometimes it doesn't always end the way you want it to. People might be angry with you. People might cry or yell or leave. But ultimately,
sure.
is it always better to get this out there?
I mean, I think, again, like that's an individual choice, and there's certainly a risk reward ratio in that, and that, you know, your perceived risk might be significantly greater than a reward that you can't necessarily quantify until you kind of know how it goes. I would say eventually it is, just because of your own self-preservation. You know, there are a lot of people that, in whatever scenario they're in, and most definitely LGBTQ situations, where genuinely their safety is at risk and they still live under their parents' house or any of those things. And I don't think, you know, there's an absolute rule you must come out of the closet. I would never push open that door for anyone. Like, that is absolutely their call. So I don't think it's an absolute rule that it's always better. I think, you know, it's an easier and healthier way to live your life. But again, that's kind of everybody's decision and how you want to do it and how many people you want to do it with. You know, do you just want to come out to one family member, just so, you know, do you want to slowly open that door, or do you want to just, you know, bust it down and come out with fireworks? I think that's kind of up to the individual and how they want to do it. I mean, my experience has always been that in the long run, it's been better. And if there's any of those things, any of those closets that you're coming out of, that there are people in your life that love you, more likely than not, I mean, they love you no matter what. And that's what they remember. And sometimes it takes people time, and those reactions are real. I mean, I would take somebody screaming back at me rather than, oh, you're gay, and then, like, crickets.
We're talking right now to Ash Beckham. She's an LGBTQ activist. She gave a TEDx talk in Boulder called Coming Out of Your Closet.
We want to hear from you. How do you handle difficult conversations? What's the hardest thing, the most difficult thing you've ever said to another person? How did you work up to revealing that about yourself? Are you planning to come out of some kind of closet? And as our guest defines it, it could be the traditional usage, being gay, or it could be a disease, or you've lost your job, or she mentioned PTSD, mental illness. Do you need advice about how to start one of these conversations? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking now with Ash Beckham. She's an LGBTQ activist. She gave a TEDx talk in Boulder called Coming Out of Your Closet. She says there's something everybody probably needs to get off their chest at some time or other in their lives, and that sometimes the holidays can force these conversations upon us, but maybe that's a good thing. We can learn how to come out of the closet.
Do you have a story about this? Was there something you had to reveal to someone close to you that maybe took you years to get out, and how did it work when you did it? What did you do? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, 800-642-1234, or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
And Ash, I want to ask you, you know, you mentioned the way that this is sort of blowing up. People have gotten in touch with you, and it sounds like this talk has changed lives. Have you heard stories about how people's lives have been changed once they decide to do this, have these tough conversations?
I mean, it's been the outpouring of support has been incredible, and I think the greatest thing about it for me is this incredible sense of community that's felt, because I feel like when you're in a closet, you feel so incredibly alone, and you feel like nobody's ever gone through it exactly the way you have. Nobody, it's never been as hard for anybody as it is for you. Like, it's really isolating, and so your only metrics are your perspective, and so this outpouring of support that I've received and that people have shared via social media and telling their stories, you know, to me or on my Facebook page or whatever, has been incredible, because there's not been one thing that I've received that I haven't gotten more than one of. You know, so starting to share those stories and you know, with their permission, posting that stuff on my page and just sharing it, there's this sense of like, yeah, it's tough for all of us, and we're in this together. And that was kind of the point of the talk, was we're so much more alike than we are different, all of us. You know, sometimes, especially now in culture, it feels like our differences are so highlighted, and, you know, we define ourselves by one of these things, often a closet that we've come out of, and to be able to be in a spot where we can have these conversations and be like, okay, I have no idea what it's like to have PTSD, but I had to come out as gay, and probably not the same thing, but I know what that feeling feels like, and when we can relate to what it feels like to be somebody else, that empathy is something that is incredible to feel, especially on this huge communal basis. But I feel like it's been felt, you know, and the talk has been maybe a nudge for some people, but it exists. That commonality exists. We just need to find it in each other.
Let's go to our first caller now, Chukwuma in Preston, Minnesota. And by the way, you can join Chukwuma and call in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Chukwuma, hi.
Hi.
Hi, what is your story?
Well, when I was a kid and realized that I was gay, my coming out, that was before we even had phrases like coming out, but I felt I had to tell my mom one morning, because I knew I had been photographed in a demonstration the night before and that it was going to be in the paper. And my lineage is old world, Eastern European, and I expected this big martyr thing from my mother. What did I do wrong? Oh, my God, and the whole story. And so I really prepared myself for this, and we were sitting in the morning having coffee, and I asked her what she thought about gay people, and she said, well, she didn't know much about that. And when I said, well, what would you say if I told you I was? And I clinched. My whole body just clammed up, because I was just waiting to hear this. My God, my God. And she just calmly sipped her coffee and looked at me, and she says, I know. She said, you're my son, and I love you. And I just freaked out, because I was so prepared for her to freak out. And it was like, when were you anxious and found out it was for naught? You know, I mean, I was just so freaked out. And my family's all gone. And I have a nun who, she was a nun when I was a little kid. She was a grown woman. And we've stayed in touch, and she's become my extended family. And she's left the convent, and she's got grandkids and all this. She's like the papyrus paper now. And I feel I need to tell her I'm gay before she dies. We talk a lot, and occasionally she says, well, you know, you're still single. But I think I need to for some reason in me, I think I need to be honest with her. And so I'm going to have to go back to Chicago to do that at some point here soon.
Well, Chukwuma, thank you for sharing that story. And it sounds like that's something that Chukwuma feels compelled to do. This is a conversation, you know, that he wants to have. What advice would you give for having a second conversation like that, Ash?
Sure. I mean, I think it's hard, and I think, you know, we should never stereotype people generationally, but certainly that would be more challenging. But it sounds like, you know, this woman is your chosen family, and I find that my experience has been that those people are pretty understanding. Like they love you and they care about you and they take you in as family because they want to. And I strongly doubt that you have had these years and this tremendous connection that she would just write that off. And, you know, it might take her a second to get her mind around it, but she no doubt, you know, loves you, and that's, you know, people surprise you and maybe think of the inspiration of your mom and what that meant, and you're hopeful. And at the end of the day, I feel like if it's something you feel like you need to do, you kind of need to let go of what that person's reaction is going to be like. Like if it is something that you want to tell someone before she dies, then it's off of your chest and it's kind of in her court to deal with it. And if she makes a decision to not be accepting, you know, that's, at least it's not on your chest anymore. It's not, you know, it's in her court.
All right. Well, thanks to Chukwuma for that call. And, you know, we've got Thanksgiving coming up in a few days. We've got Hanukkah. We've got Christmas. And these are times when sometimes we're pressed into close contact with people that we do need to have these talks with. Maybe we don't see them all the time. Is there something about picking your moment? Should you wait until it's a less pressurized time, like the holidays? You know, they come with a lot of baggage already. Should we wait until, you know, maybe it's kind of between seasons?
Sure. I mean, it kind of depends on how you want to have that conversation. You know, maybe with the members of your immediate family, you want to wait and have that conversation more of a one-on-one basis, you know, not charged with all the other relatives around. But if those people already know and you need to come out to the rest of your family and they're not people that you see too often, then sometimes it makes sense to have the support of the people in your immediate family or your friends or whoever that know to say it and know that your support is standing right there next to you. I mean, I think that that's pretty critical. And again, that, you know, the holidays are a bit charged and an interesting time, but also, you know, often it's something that you could see. If these aren't people you see often, you're not going to have to see them for another year. So, you know, why live a life you don't need to? And, you know, you can get away from it. But again, you know, I feel like every family dynamic is different and you just kind of need to assess what you're ready for and be more concerned with what you can handle than what they can handle.
And we've heard this TED Talk that we have it up on our Facebook page, by the way. You've been on our radio show. We've heard your message here. So what is next for you in spreading this message about people coming out of the closet?
Yeah, you know, it's been really interesting. This is not something that I ever expected. And it's certainly not the reason that I wrote it, but I feel like there's an energy that's out there and a commonality of people that are, you know, taking this and hearing it and then applying it to their life and making the world a better place. And I feel so incredibly honored that I can have just a small part in people living a more free and open life. So, you know, I've had some inquiries from some places to go and do talks, and obviously now we be on the LGBTQ stuff. So I'm, you know, getting through the holidays, I'm actually sitting outside of Bloomfield Hills High School in Detroit, Michigan, about to go see my little 2.5-year-old niece in a holiday play. So I'm taking the holidays and spending with my family, and then when I get back to Colorado in around the first of the year, hopefully putting together a schedule and some, you know, tour dates for 2014.
All right, sounds good.
Really exciting.
Ash, we're out of time, but thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, so thank you so much. Have a great holiday.
Ash Beckham, LGBTQ activist. She gave a TEDx talk in Boulder. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.